discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the final hour of This Weekend for my show, Weekends with Jason Olborn, here on TNT. And by no means, well, goodness me, it is the probably the most powerful of all the interviews, and we've had some rippers this weekend. And if you've missed them, please check our website, and you can download them through video, audio, even on Rumble now. You can check in and see whatever interviews that you've missed out on. But in this hour, we're going to be talking about David McBride, our very own, and also Julian Assange. I have not one, but two guests, and I'm going to introduce them momentarily. But before I do, I just want to recap the story from this week. And I'm going to quote from Crikey, of all newspapers or media organisations. Don't necessarily agree with a lot that goes on there, but on this occasion I do. And it says to me that politics is not so much about left and right anymore. And as I mentioned in the last hour, could be about globalism versus nationalism or something else. It should just be about people. And of course, with honest, hard facts and not ideology pretending to be science as an example. So let's quote from Peter Grest's article where he wrote on Tuesday, ACT Supreme Court Justice David Mossop dispatched the former military lawyer David McBride to prison for 5 years and 8 months for passing classified military documents to journalists. Those documents form the basis of the ABC's explosive Afghan files investigation, revealing allegations that Australian soldiers were involved in the unlawful executions of unarmed civilians. Let me say that again, that this exposed that Australian soldiers were involved in the unlawful execution of unarmed civilians. And as David writes, it is hard to think any whistleblowing more important. David McBride's case forced us to confront the way our own troops had been conducting the war in Afghanistan, as well as the government's ongoing obsession with secrecy over the public interest. McBride has been concerned about what he saw as systemic failures of the SAS commanders and their inconsistency in dealing with the deaths of non-combatants in Afghanistan. In an affidavit, he saw the way frontline troops were being improperly prosecuted to cover up leadership in action and the failure to hold reprehensible conduct to account. He initially complained internally, writes Grest, but then nothing happened. He decided to go public in 2014 and 15. David collected 235 military documents and gave them to the ABC. The documents included 207 classified as secret and others marked as cabinet papers. It is hard to deny the truth of what David exposed. The Brereton inquiry later found what a parliamentary briefing described as credible information of 23 incidents in which non-combatants were unlawfully killed by or at the direction of the Australian Special Forces. The report said these may constitute the war crime of murder. Brereton went on to recommend prosecutions of the soldiers who are allegedly responsible, yet the first person to face trial and be sent to prison in the whole debacle is not any of those who might have been responsible for the alleged killings, but the man who exposed misconduct in the Australian Defence Force. Much has been made of McBride's reasons for going to the media, but this focus on motives is a form of misdirection, writes Peter Grest. Whistleblowers take action for a host of reasons, some of them less honourable than others, but ultimately what matters is the truth of what they expose rather than the why. Well, my guests this hour, Kathy Vogan is a journalist and executive producer for Consortium News, and Eddie Lloyd is an accredited specialist criminal lawyer, a former councillor elected to Lismore City Council, a community advocate and busy mum. She's also an accredited doublespeak translator and dedicated to promoting truth and transparency in government and getting justice for David McBride. Kathy and Eddie, welcome to Weekends.
Great to be here. Welcome. Thank you for me.
It's wonderful, ladies, to have you both on the show. And just to explain, Eddie, we've had a bit of difficulty with internet and I feel your pain. I've had a similar problem here where I have. And just for those that are wondering, most of the time it's good now. I switched to Starlink and my internet speeds have more than quadrupled in that space. Who would have thought that satellite is better than the NBN? But here we are, complete aside. But thank you both for being on the show today.
Welcome.
It's just an extraordinary situation. Kathy, if I could start with you, if we can just get into it, recollecting what happened in the courtroom this week, can you describe the scenes that went down after this? It seemingly an endless announcement of David's sentencing.
It took 2.5 hours for the judge Mossop to read out his reasons for what was to come. but to a courtroom that was packed. It was a small courtroom, and there were some 80 people in there, standing room only. And there were heckles as soon as the judge came into the room. With the very first thing we heard was shame on the court. I looked around. It was an elderly lady. She was not held in contempt. And Mossop simply said, "Will you please sit down and be quiet," in a in a somewhat schoolmaster way. So when I think I should tell you about what happened during that time, because anyone can have a call of nature. And I was tweeting out live from the courtroom, but I asked the person beside me, who was an ABC journalist, "Will you please tell me what he said when I come back?" I didn't take very long, and I turned around and saw the crowd, and I was just bowled over. But at the back of the room there were three policemen, and when I saw the three policemen, I thought, "Oh dear, it looks like he's going to go down." And sure enough, when the judgment was finally delivered, the crowd went crazy. David was very calm about it, but there was so much disorder in the courtroom that Judge Mossop just ran out the door. Literally, there were no formalities, no bows or anything. He ran away. And there was David standing with his dog. A lady took his who seemed to have gowns on, took his dog, and the three policemen had walked up and they led him out the door. There were a lot of people crying. I confess that I was teary-eyed myself once it became obvious that this was about to happen. There were children in the room as well, and everyone was just so shocked that it was going, go down that way, and so severely. 5 years and 8 months, 2 years and 3 months period of non-parole. And we just didn't know why it had been so severe. If I could just make the remark of, in response to what Peter Grest has said, if this is all about people, well, then there is, let's talk about the public interest, because in my mind there is a total inconsistency. One of the three journalists that David McBride gave the documents to was Daniel Oakes from the ABC. Now, who went after David McBride? Well, the Attorney General permitted this, but it's essentially the Commonwealth Direction of Public Prosecutions, which we refer to as the CDPP. Now, the seat in the case, you will remember, the whole world will probably remember, that the Australian National Broadcaster was raided by the Australian Federal Police to try and find these documents. And we had it all live tweeted to us. So we knew what was going on inside. And they found what they were looking for. And very strangely, the Commonwealth Direction of Public Prosecutions gave advice to the federal police that although it would be easy to obtain a conviction of this particular journalist who had published classified material, it was not in the public interest to prosecute journalists, and especially journalists that were reporting on war crimes. So now, why did the CDPP decide that it wasn't in the public interest that David McBride have a defence? Why was it in the public interest to prosecute him, when both of these people had collaborated in a project that resulted in the same outcome, the public disclosure of war crimes in Afghanistan, and in David's case, the cover-up by people at the top brass, people at the top? Maybe that's the difference.
Well, my first follow-up question, I know I've got to bring Eddie on in a moment, but quickly, Kathy, why is Julian Assange locked up then?
Yeah, well, Julian Assange has always given us information about people do wrongdoing. WikiLeaks' motto once was, privacy for individuals, transparency for government. And of course, it's if you go after people in high places who have committed crimes, guilty of corruption, but are able to pass secrecy laws to hide that, of course, you're going to be end up making, as Julian said, you're going to end up making a few enemies. And he, you know, he's made quite a few enemies, namely the United States. But my goodness, he has made a lot of friends among the people, but also every human rights organization, media organization, and right up to heads of states of other countries. And we sincerely hope that, you know, the US will pull its head in and just end this, because he's suffered enough now.
Oh, it's just extraordinary. So on one hand, you don't prosecute journalists, but on the other, when it doesn't suit us, we'll go after them. Now, Eddie Lloyd, as a criminal lawyer watching on in the case of David McBride's sentencing, can you describe your reaction, and did this fit into your expectations?
Well, you know, I used to be a law lecturer in the ethics and criminal law, and if I was going to write a textbook on procedure of criminal law, I would have a chapter called Travesty of Justice, and this case would be the best case to illustrate what a travesty of justice looks like. It has been a horror show from go to woe. It has been an absolute, we've seen a failure at every turn in terms of the way his complaint has been handled. His initial concerns none of his complaints have ever been properly investigated. And what was quite astounding, I met Kathy back in, November last year, when we were both in there for the trial reporting and tweeting away. Kathy and I have really been on our own in terms of the style of reporting. I mean, I wouldn't call Kathy and I as having a style. I think we were just reporting the facts, because the gallery was full of journalists from all different places, and they are all working on their own agendas, and that has been made patently clear. There's been so much unfortunate cherry picking of facts to suit personal agendas. And it's been, I think, one of the most harrowing things, and I really appreciate what Peter Grest wrote in that Crikey article about this focus on David McBride's motive and what a distraction that has been. Why does it matter what his motive is? And how dare anybody out there, a journalist, impose their own opinion of his mens rea, of his mental state, of his motive in circumstances where so much of the evidence was hidden from the public, and some of it hidden in a safe from the judge. So we don't have the full story, and people out there reporting and saying that he had this particular motive or that particular motive, and the whole story has been about David McBride and what a complex personality, what complex motives he has had, which has been a very, very disappointing turn of events for me as a lawyer and as a member of the Australian public. Because why aren't we talking about the secret court? Why aren't we talking about the evidence that was shoved in the safe? Why aren't we talking about the deterioration of our democracy, the separation of powers, and the encroaching of the Attorney General into the remit of the judiciary by not even allowing the judge able to see the evidence? We are living in scary times. We cannot call ourselves a democracy when we have the executive arm of government and the parliament encroaching on the only avenue that the public have to turn to when there has been an overreach in the other two powers. So for me, this has always been a case about the legal profession, and it has always been a case about the breach of the separation of powers doctrine and the disintegration of our democracy. And I think what's been missed here is there was a lot of focus on the oath last year in the pre-trial arguments. And in my view, not enough focus on what I think is the real crux of the issue here, and that is not David McBride's motive, but that is his duty as a lawyer, as a member of the esteemed legal profession. And it appears that Judge Mossop, when he ruled against him on duty last year and said, you know, his duty was to his commander, to his higher up, and nothing else trumped that duty. When he made that decision, I found that deeply offensive. Because what he has done is actually thrown away hundreds and hundreds of years of legal tradition in terms of a lawyer's legislated paramount duty to the court, which includes the public, and to the administration of justice. And I think people have been in the legal profession are starting to wake up to that and ask questions like, if all his McBride's job was to obey, then why on earth did he need to be admitted as a lawyer to get the job as a military lawyer? Why do you need a law degree if your legal duties to report an alleged crime, it's a mandatory legislative duty, if that doesn't count, then why do they need any military lawyers to have a law degree?
Absolutely. And we're going to explore more of that after the break, Eddie. Now, we are going to take that first break. What I'm going to do when I come back is I'm also going to put up the cover of David's recent book called The Nature of Honour. I'm going to encourage you to consider purchasing this book, whether you do it online or in one of the department stores. I picked up my copy recently, $20-something, and it's just a tiny token that we'll get back eventually to David's legal fighting fund for his appeal. I think that's important that if we believe in something that we try and contribute whichever way we can. But at the same time, you're going to read an incredible book about an incredible man who also had a very, very amazing heroic and also flawed father in Dr. William McBride. And to understand that history is to understand Australia at its absolute best. In many ways, we're all flawed characters one way or another, but what David and what his father, William, have achieved one way or another is just something that is part of the Australian story. Now, if you love a good documentary, then you'll love our special screenings. Uninterrupted Cinema features some of the latest or notable documentaries from the world's best filmmakers, and you can check out TNT's website for more information. Weekends are better when you spend it with us on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, welcome back to Weekends, and you'll note that coming up in the next hour is cinema. So I've got my days right, and of course I was referring to this habit I have of getting Alex wrong, but he's not on today. He was on yesterday. Now, I'm going to call for the book title for David McBride's book, The Nature of Honour, if we can put that up on the screen for those of you that are watching, listening, and would like to know a little bit more about our David McBride, who obviously had a show here on TNT, if you'd like to purchase his book. And that's what we're talking about today, of course, in this hour with Kathy Bogan from Consortium News and Eddie Lloyd, a criminal lawyer who've both been following in this case. I'm just saying that to encourage you that if you want to pick up the book, it's an incredible story. I didn't know a lot about David's father, for example, Dr. William McBride, apart from the fact, there's the book cover there, apart from the fact that Dr. William McBride was the doctor who exposed thalidomide Imagine that. Officially, the worst medical medicine tragedy of all time, but COVID will certainly come along and eclipse that when the world also awakens to that particular story. That's another one coming up. However, back into the subject today. Now, I just want to bring this one up and perhaps a comment from both ladies. Kathy, the term secret is, as JFK, the slain president, said, is abhorrent, a term that secrecy has been used here to cover up murder. And that's all David did was uncover it. That term that could literally just be stamped onto a document makes that off limits. How bad is that from the term of transparency that government is meant to be transparent? This is the exact opposite, covering up possibly the worst crime there is.
Well, that's a legal matter too. And it's very interesting. During the trial, King's Counsel came in, Andrew Berger KC, came in and explained why there was a problem with disclosing evidence. This is why David McBride had to plead guilty. And what he specifically said was that it could be damaging to our foreign partners. Now, I asked David a question, and the question was, it's about the law in terms of the, not so much the obligation to disclose, but the illegality of hiding crime through classification. In the United States, they have an executive order from 2009, Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7, Obama's law, that it is illegal to classify evidence of a crime or where it is just to hide embarrassment. So I asked David McBride, is it also illegal in Australia to be classifying crime? And he said it absolutely is. So not only was it his duty under the what was it called? The Legal Professional Uniform Law, Australian Solicitors Conduct Rules 2015. This is Regulation 3.1. As Eddie said, a solicitor's duty to the court and the administration of justice is paramount and prevails to the extent of inconsistency with any other duty. But it is also illegal for those people to classify crime.
Goodness me. Eddie, if you'd like to add something there, I mean, I know that you will, but this secret stamp, the idea of covering up murder, I mean, goodness me, I work as a counsellor. If somebody comes to me and gives me certain information, it's reportable. But how can murder not be reportable, or at least in the public interest, made known?
Well, I think, and this is where, and I'm not criticising you at all, but this is where the kind of narrative has gone into probably inconsistent with exactly what David McBride's motives. So much time has passed since he initially made the report to police. So, of course, if you want to report a crime, you go to the police and you would hope that they investigate it. As a lawyer, what we had here was a very senior military lawyer with the highest vetting clearance to access to, you know, the most classified documents. He goes to the AFP to report a number of very serious criminal offences, which is his duty under the Legal Professional Act as a lawyer to do that. Otherwise, he'd be committing an offence if he didn't, of concealing a serious indictable offence. He alleged that there had been a perversion of the course of justice, that there had been some fraudulent activity in the misuse of Commonwealth resources, that there had been an interference with himself actually in performing his legal duty and prejudicing ADF members. So he went to the AFP to report these crimes. And within an hour, the two Keystone cop constables down at Canberra AFP station said, nothing to see here. They didn't even take his complaint seriously. And actually, nobody has taken his complaint seriously to this day. But what we have seen is the Attorney General swoop into the remit of the judiciary and make public interest claims over a whole swathe of evidence in fact, the very evidence that David McBride needed to defend himself, coincidentally, and removed that under this National Security Act, and under, you know, to claim that, that if this evidence was to be disclosed to the public, that it would cause, you know, very serious harm to Australia's national security. And what was so astounding and ironic that not a lot of people picked up, I know Kathy picked up on it, I picked up on it straight away in the court, was the reason why Judge Moffat seemed to give such a harsh penalty to David McBride was because of one of the sentencing principles he put a lot of weight on general deterrence, that people can't just go out there and steal Commonwealth property and leak it to journalists and expect no recourse. Okay, that's the general the definition of what general deterrence is that he put a lot of weight on. Now, that was very, very inconsistent with a couple of things. The first thing, let's not forget that Dave McBride is a veteran and he was experiencing PTSD compounded by the gaslighting he received over the many years, no doubt, and a number of other mental health conditions that an expert psych had opined was linked to his state of mind at the time of the offending. But the other thing that is really important to remember is what Judge Mossop omitted really in terms of the principle of general deterrence and why he gave so much weight to that to put him into jail. He didn't, in my respectful opinion, he did not disclose candidly and openly to the public. And no one has really reported this much except for Kathy and I, and that is that this material that David McBride leaked, that was so highly classified, that was so sensitive, that led to his honour assess his offending as moderate and high seriousness, and is the reason why he got a full-time custodial sentence. This very sensitive material that could have done so much damage. There was no evidence of any actual damage, but there was talk of prejudice still may arise in the future of something that happened 10 years ago on a hill in Afghanistan. But putting that aside, it was so sensitive. In the agreed statement of facts, it was disclosed that the AFT and the ADF had not even searched his computer, the ABC's computer, the ADF computer, to see if anyone else had accessed this highly sensitive material. And I just thought, boom, there you go. What is this case really about? What is the nature of these documents? What are they called sensitive and classified for? And if anyone has been around and paying attention to the case and watched David speak at numerous events, he's always been of the view that those documents really just expose the criminality of the leadership in covering up things. Now, when David began his job as a legal officer, he's sitting at a desk and he's looking at a lot of paperwork. He's representing soldiers who have misused their travel card, deciding whether to prosecute people or not, looking at reports that inquiry officers like Roger Shanahan has done. He was one of the inquiry officers, looking at different reports and just making sure that all the boring boxes have been ticked in terms of the law being complied with, regulations, rules of engagement, and deciding whether or not there was reasonable suspicion to, you know, engage in an investigation. So they do an administrative inquiry first, which is really the paperwork. And that was his job. Now, since that date, of course, we've had the Brereton inquiry and we know so much more. But when David was doing his desk job at the ADF, he was told that the rules of engagement needed to be changed. This is the first thing that happened that aroused his suspicion. He was said these rules of engagement need to change. He said, why? And they produced three incidents that had happened the year before, three reports from incidents the year before. On the face of that paperwork, what he had before him, there was no reasonable suspicion to investigate. And in fact, none of those investigations had even been finalised. So he said, well, well, this can't be the basis for the change in the rules of engagement. And he asked more questions. And he was told, oh, no, no, the Attorney General and the Minister have obtained legal advice from the Australian Government solicitor that says that the rules of engagement must be changed. So he urged them to produce that. And eventually, and he's really starting to annoy them at this stage because they don't like people asking questions, they produced that. And the advice was consistent with what McBride had said, that the rules of engagement did not need changing. So his suspicions was aroused. So at that stage, he did not know what was going on the year before in the worst killing year of 2012. He was just doing his boring job as a lawyer and saying, hang on a second, which is your job as a lawyer, we've got to uphold the law and make sure that everyone is applying it without fear or favour, that these boring procedures and regulations are being followed, that investigations are carried out lawfully, and we don't have people investigating out of jurisdiction like what happened in one of the cases David was involved with, where the ADFIS, the ADF Investigative Service, flew over from Australia and intervened and into an investigation without jurisdiction. That was another issue for David McBride. So he was just saying, what's going on here? Why is everything changing all of a sudden? And we can all speculate now, looking back, now we know what the Brereton Inquiry revealed, that perhaps what might have happened, which is what McBride has always speculated, is that they were suddenly investigating because there were rumours going around about killings, unlawful killings and kill counts and whatnot in 2012, and they wanted to suddenly look like they took the law seriously and that they would investigate people. Because, of course, as David McBride reveals in his book, one of the cases he was involved with, Beachy, I think he calls him in the book, he believed was being improperly investigated. Beachy was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing, and that was what he was complaining about. Quite a boring story, not as graphic and salacious as some in the media would like it to be, but that was what he was doing. And he really did trigger this explosion that has ultimately led to the Brereton Inquiry and the revelation. But sadly, of course, and hopefully we'll get to talk about that, what the Brereton Inquiry did not lead to.
Yes, we will, and we'll mention that after the break. I just want to ask you, what were you hoping would be, given the fact that he was kind of pigeonholed into a guilty plea, what were you hoping the judge would hand down as a sentence?
Well, when we adjourned last year, His Honour ordered an intensive corrections order, and that is a very clear sign that that's probably what you're going to get. If you pass the test, you have to have an assessment with an intensive corrections order officer, who, you know, he, you know, had to provide an address in Canberra, you know, probably had to say he was willing to do community service. There might have been health checks and things like that that he had to do. He passed that test, and that's something that Judge Mossop ordered. And a judge will only order that if they think that the penalty, you know, of intensive corrections order, a term of imprisonment in the communities, which is what it is an appropriate penalty. So Judge Mossop, who was the one front and centre, saw all the evidence except for the evidence that was hidden in the safe that no one else has seen to this date. He was the one that saw all of the evidence in the pre-trial arguments, and he was the one that came to that view. And so I wonder what changed between that date and the sentencing hearing, because what we had at the sentencing hearing were written submissions, so that's not really evidence. I mean, obviously written submissions, and they were orally put to the court as well. You know, that includes, you know, around a summary of the case and the Crown saying why the death penalty should apply and David's lawyers saying why an ICO is appropriate, as His Honour had ordered. In addition, included in the defence bundle was a psychological report, which was the expert opinion on David's mental health and the impact on, you know, of his mental health conditions on his decision making, the impact of him and his two daughters and his former wife and his puppy, should he go into custody, and all of those things. So that was it. That was a change. That was fresh evidence before the court. And I'm not sure that I heard anything that was fresh that came from the Commonwealth prosecutor that would justify a change so drastically in his honours assessment of his offending that now he deemed warranted a full-time custodial sentence. So that's, I found that astounding. And as Cathy noted before, and as a lawyer, I know, like, as soon as you see the men in blue in the back of the court before the, as soon as I saw them, I thought, yeah, he's going in, he's getting slotted today. And it was very, very, very sad. It was very emotional. I think I was the only one who didn't cry. I was trying to hold myself together for supporting Sarah, his former wife. And, it was very devastating. I don't think people really, no one in the media really talked about the whole Jake issue. Like, David McBride is a veteran. You know, he's got PTSD. He's been on the front lines and he's had years and years and years of trauma and gaslighting and fighting this case and having it hanging over his head and bail conditions and the impact on his family and the financial detriment, the emotional detriment. He's got an assistance dog that lives by his side 24/7. And if anyone has seen Dave in public with Jake, they will know that. He's patting Jake constantly because of his PTSD. It calms him down, and I think he does the same for Jake. It's a beautiful little relationship. It's a real story of a man's best friend. So when Dave got carted off down to the gallows, oh, Jake, he was so upset. It was just horrendous. I had to grab him. I could barely hold him back. He's a staffy. He's so strong, and I just had to grab him and hold him, and he was shaking. Like shaking like a fish. It was just horrendous, and I know that that's going to be very hard for Dave, as well as one of his daughters, Georgie. She's still in school. They're incredibly close, so I know that he's going to be doing it really tough in the Alexander McConaughey Centre, and he will be appealing the judgment. I think he'll be doing a conviction and a severity appeal, and if I could just do a call out. There's an amazing video that's on his YouTube site. If you just Google David McBride YouTube, you'll find it all through his website. It's called If You're Seeing This, I'm in Jail. There's a GoFundMe attached to that that is put up to help raise some funds for his legal appeal. And it's a wonderful video. It's had 1.2 million views and it's only been up for 4 days and it's going viral across the world. And I hope that it's arousing attention and fear in everybody, because it was a dark day for democracy when he got carted down to the gallows, and a very, very, very sad indictment on the Australian government.
Yeah, goodness me, it's shocking. It cuts to the core, and when you know David, like many of us are lucky enough to have done, you realise that this was only ever done with the right intentions. Now we are going to take a break, and we'll be back with more. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
Sometimes life can be overwhelming, and suicide may seem like the only way to relieve the pain. Beyond Now is an evidence-based app created by Beyond Blue to help you cope when suicidal thoughts start to appear. You can use it to create an easy-to-follow plan that is personal to you and includes steps like know your warning signs so you can act early, make your environment safe by removing harmful items, activities you can do or people you can be with to distract yourself from suicidal thoughts. Reminders of things that make you feel strong. Some of these steps might be tough to fill out, and that's okay. It can be helpful to make or share your safety plan with a trusted friend, family member, or mental health professional. You might feel like you're alone, but help is available. If you're worried you can't stay safe, use the red telephone icon to call your emergency contacts. Download the free Beyond Now app today to create your personal safety plan.
You are loved. You are valued. You are resilient. You got this.
You are there for them. We are here for you. Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving.
Discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, it's been a tough hour from the perspective of hearing what our friend and colleague David McBride went through this week when he was sentenced to 5 years and 8 months. And we've had both Kathy Vogan, journalist, and Eddie Lloyd, criminal lawyer, with me for this hour. Now, I'm going to cross back to Kathy, who's over in the UK at the moment. You're there, Kathy, because this week you'll be attending the latest update of what's happening with our other Australian hero in waiting that's been, the whole thing's been confused, Julian Assange. Can you tell us what's going on, please?
Okay, well, Julian Assange last year lodged an appeal against his extradition, a 150-page appeal, which was summarily dismissed, the whole thing, without much commentary, by Justice Swift of the High Court. And then he was permitted one last-chance appeal in front of two judges, Dame Victoria Sharp, who's the head of the King's Bench, and Justice Jeremy Johnson. Now, there were 9 points to that appeal. The judges, we were told by Swift that it was going to last 30 minutes in total, but it ended up lasting 2 days. And the whole of the first day was given to the defence to deliver their 9 points of appeal. Now, there were very strong points, including the CIA's kidnap or kill plot. You know, you would think that that would be enough. The CIA spying, you know, prosecution essentially, spying on the defence. You'd think that would kill a case as well, but nothing has been normal in the Julian Assange case. However, the judges did consider that on 3 of the 9 points, and they took some time to consider this, but eventually they gave a reply and said there were 3 of the 9 points that he could potentially appeal, go on to have his High Court appeal, not the full one, but only on possibly, maybe 3 points. And they were that the question of whether Julian Assange would face the death penalty if extradited, and based on the same facts, if additional charges were laid. The second one was whether, and this is very serious as well, on whether he would be, quote, and this is the judge's commentary, potentially very greatly prejudiced at trial in the United States by way of his nationality. And thirdly, specifically, if Julian Assange would be able to rely on the First Amendment. Now, what we have discovered since, and what the argument that we will no doubt hear in court, is that it has been a matter of long established law in the United States that and which was echoed in the Supreme Court in June 2020 by Justice Kavanaugh, that foreign nationals who acted abroad, it has to be both, right, do not have any constitutional rights whatsoever. So, of course, that includes the First Amendment and also the Fifth Amendment, which relates to the unprecedented nature of this case. No journalist has ever been convicted of espionage in the United States. So the problem is that, especially in 2010, Julian Assange could not have foreseen that his actions in publishing would be considered illegal. In fact, it wasn't made clear to anybody, even the defense and the prosecution, in the conclusions of the two-day appeal hearing, renewal appeal hearing, it was called, weren't quite sure whether Julian Assange would have any rights at all in the United States. And Judge Sharp got a bit impatient and said, look, I want a consensus opinion in writing. From, you know, whether he has rights or not. And then, as it turned out, it was exactly as CIA Director Mike Pompeo had threatened, that he said he thinks that he would be protected by the First Amendment. Well, he will not. And we all thought it was because of what Biden wanted to prove, that he had conspired to obtain the documents. That's what crossed the line into espionage. But that was blown away in court by a forensic examiner. So we still weren't quite sure. And then it finally became clear to everyone that this was a situation he was facing. Now, rather than just set a date for the appeal that Julian was to be permitted, the judges made a strange move, quite unusual in my view. They decided to give the United States another shot at providing assurances. This was the second time. The lower court judge had decided not to extradite Julian Assange for two reasons. Most people are aware that this is to do with his mental health, but also it was the appalling state of US prisons and what Julian Assange knew he would be facing, because of course they torture folks over there. They torture their own. In Europe, it's considered more than for 14 days, torture includes shutting somebody in solitary confinement. You have people in the United States who have been totally isolated for over 40 years, right? So, you know, you could classify a suicide as a rational act under those circumstances, knowing that you're going to be facing you're going to be shut inside a metal shoebox for the rest of your days, and you're never going to see another human being, just eyes at the door and a hand pushing food through a slot. So we waited for assurances, and then rather than get, there were three points, right, that the judges asked for assurances. There were only two came back. Now, there was the death penalty assurance, and of course that seemed solid. And people say, well, they don't really want him dead. They prefer to torture him. But of course, you have to understand, because of the separation of powers in the United States, that the executive cannot give an assurance regarding the decision of a judge. So they could say, no, he won't be facing the death penalty, but the judge could think differently. So that's really the bottom line with that one, and that's the only point to consider. But then they gave what the Australian Senator David Shoebridge called, well, he said that many lawyers would call a mendacious or deceitful assurance, where the notion of him being potentially very greatly prejudiced, be it by way of his nationality and the specific First Amendment question, they were both rolled into the one assurance. And what they said was that Julian Assange could seek to rely on the First Amendment, but whether that right was granted was entirely a matter for a judge, for the court to decide. Now, of course, they were kind of telling the truth in a way, as I explained before. It really is a separation of powers there, and the judiciary cannot be officially dictated by the executive, but also the executive can't assure on behalf of the judiciary. So, you know, that's where we stand at the moment. We are waiting to find out if the judges find these two assurances sufficient. That's what they will either be sufficient or not, and the judges could reject all three points, or they could accept all three points. And in fact, they could realize that this is a cul-de-sac, that this question about the separation of powers and the executive not being able to assure on what these judges need assurance on, that Julian Assange will not lose these fundamental rights if he is taken out of the European jurisdiction, where the European Convention on Human Rights says that everyone is protected, but the American Constitution, or the law as it stands, does not, the Constitution does not protect foreign nationals who acted abroad. And in that respect, it's somewhat discriminatory. It's a form of discrimination that can't be resolved. So they could close the case because of this matter, or they could ignore the fact that there is no sufficient assurance. They could ignore what, any arguments that are put forward about this this matter by Mark Summers and Mr. Fitzgerald, Edward Fitzgerald, for the defence. Just ignore them and say, oh, yeah, that'll do. Somewhat like they did the last time when the US said that he would be fine if extradited, despite the mental health problems. We'll look after him. Oh, okay. But of course, Supreme Court law in the UK has changed as well. And there was a landmark case called AAA versus the Home Secretary, where it was Supreme Court decision, opinion, I should say, that it is no longer the Home Secretary's business to say whether a country is safe, that this must be tested in court, in a court of law, on the basis of real world evidence and also the country's track history. So in a way, we are seeing more of a discussion now play out about assurances. Let's hope that, the best outcome out of three could be that they decide, well, this is a dead end. We're going to close this case because we can never get the assurances that we need, that justice, that Julian Assange will be treated fairly under the law in a country that he's extradited to. Or they could mendaciously themselves pretend that they've received sufficient assurances, or that they could also reject all three or one, any number of them, and permit further appeal on that point or 2 points or possibly all 3 points.
It's an extraordinary development and incredibly frustrating that there's three very, very distinct outcomes. He could literally end the case now because you can't trust the US government to not provide the death penalty, or you could drag it out, make an appeal, or you just send him that all the way through. And we've only got about 2 minutes left. Eddie, would you like to comment on this particular situation with Julian Assange?
Yeah, thanks. As a double speak accredited translator, I can tell you that when they say there's an assurance, it means the absolute opposite. We've really gone down through the looking glass here. And you don't need to be a lawyer to understand the case of Julian Assange and of David McBride. America think that they rule the world. They think they've got jurisdiction over everybody. There's been nothing that came out of that judgment that could be credibly called an assurance at all. Everything is going to depend on when he gets to the States, what will happen. And it's much the same as here in Australia, when people have been calling out for the Australian government and Albanese to get his megaphone out and start publicly denouncing the treatment of and the extradition prospects for Julian Assange. But he said, no, we're doing everything behind closed doors. It's okay. We're just negotiating. And FOI gets done. All of a sudden, we see nothing's been done. All we know about a prisoner transfer option for Julian Assange is like the other assurance. When he gets there, when he's charged, if the charge is eligible for a prisoner transfer treaty for him to come back to Australia, then they will assess that. So I think we're really in Orwellian times at the moment. And if anyone thinks that these court cases are without political interference, then they need to go and read 1984, I think, because I have no doubt that it got adjourned, much like McBride's case got adjourned, in the hope that the public would kind of just dissipate, there wouldn't be so much attention, and they can extradite him. Obviously, they should not be extraditing Julian Assange. Obviously, they should not have jailed David McBride. Obviously, what we're seeing going on in the courts is just a theatre performance, and all of the real truth of everything is happening behind closed doors, and it's time that we shone some light into those doors and told the rest of Australia what's actually going on, so we can return the power to the people and not to a few people in the dark corridors of Parliament.
Eddie Lloyd and Cathy Bogan, thank you both for your time. Unfortunately, we've run out. Your work is impeccable, and it was a delight to have you on the show to update us on this unfortunately double solemn occasion. But our hopes are with Julian as we look forward. We have to go. Cinema is next. I'll see you all next week.